Listener Production.
Australia Today. Australia Today. Honest opinion. Real talk.
Welcome to Australia Today. It is Wednesday, the 14th of December. Steve Price with you. A news update with Natasha Belling in just one moment. The horror of what unfolded yesterday as we went to air in Wyambeelia with the tragic deaths of Queensland, two Queensland police officers, still has most of Australia shocked, I think. Rachel Crowe and Matthew Arnold killed execution style. Two other officers traumatised and a community still reeling. We'll be joined shortly by Ian Leavers from the Queensland Police Union. But some of the detail coming out of this shocking incident continues to spill out. The Daily Telegraph and The Australian reporting this morning that the trio, so this is the two brothers that are now dead, the train brothers, and one of the brothers' wife, Stacey, were involved in some sort of bizarre love triangle. Nathaniel may have been married to Stacey before his brother married her. I mean, this stuff is just even more strange than you would imagine. One source told The Australian that they were involved in a love tryst, with police now trying to understand the dynamic between the brothers and Stacey in the lead up to the bloodshed. Those three, of course, are all dead. Locals have also claimed that the train brothers had been using methamphetamine and bragging about turning Gareth and Stacey's two-bedroom home into a bunker. The Daily Mail reports a close family member told one local that the home had been moved completely off the grid. The brothers had installed solar panels, satellite dishes, rainwater and septic tanks. He said it had tunnels, fortified and barred doors and windows, guns everywhere, and the boys had been taking ice lately. A local from a nearby town of Tara said. Now, Tara, of course, is where the police officers came from. Mystery still surrounds how Nathaniel, once a respected school teacher with a reputation for turning around struggling schools, became a cold-blooded police killer. He was last seen in Dubbo in December 2021. Serious concerns raised for his welfare when he stopped contacting his family. So that's why the police went there in the first place. That's why they went to the home to see if they could find him. And we now know what happened. I'll talk to the police union about that shortly. But first on this Wednesday morning, a very good morning to Natasha Belling.
Good morning, Steve. Let's check the headlines. And a desperate search is underway this morning for a woman who has fell overboard from a cruise ship off South Australia's east coast. Carnival Australia says the young passenger fell off the Pacific Explorer around 11:30 last night. The cruise ship left Melbourne on Tuesday and was on its way to Kangaroo Island. In other news this morning, the community of Chinchilla in regional Queensland is mourning the loss of two of their own after that horrific shooting left six people dead. Constables Matthew Arnold and Rachel McCrow were shot and killed on Monday night by brothers Nathaniel and Gareth Train and Gareth's wife Stacey while the officers were performing a routine welfare check at the property in Western Downs. Local pastor Lee Dorman from the Church of Christ has told Channel 9 support is being offered to the devastated local community.
We need to keep the conversation going, and that's the main thing, get people talking as a town, talking out their grief, and lots of hugs, lots of tears, but this is how we do it. We come together like this.
Meantime, one of the police officers who escaped the fatal shooting will hopefully be released from hospital today. Soon-to-be father of two, Randall Kirk, suffered a gunshot wound to the leg during the ordeal, while fellow officer Keely Brow hid in a nearby bush. Queensland Police Commissioner Katarina Carroll has told the ABC this morning the surviving officers are doing as well as they can.
There isn't anything good about it. Our hearts are breaking. As everyone knows, there certainly was a hail of bullets, and I went to the scene yesterday. These officers didn't stand a chance. And in my opinion, I cannot believe how two actually survived.
Former Prime Minister Scott Morrison will front the Robo-Debt Royal Commission today. The ex-leader was Social Services Minister when the failed Welfare Debt Recovery Program was launched, wrongfully collecting $720 million from thousands of Australians. And Staying Alive by the Bee Gees and Juliet Gillard's misogyny speech have now been officially etched into Australian history. They're two of 10 sounds added to the official National Film and Sound Archive Sound of Australia catalogue this year. And we certainly can't forget this one either.
Neighbours, everybody needs good neighbours.
Some sounds I'd rather forget, Steve.
Which one?
Neighbours.
You didn't like that?
Look, I like the series, not so much the theme song.
No, the theme song wasn't great. The Bee Gees, did you ever see them live?
No, I didn't. I'm too young.
No, you're not. one of the first things that ever took place at Sydney Homebush Olympic Park. They did it as a trial run for the Sydney 2000 Olympic Games. So it means probably early 2000. I sat three rows from the front and watched a Bee Gees concert. They were unbelievable.
In the mosh pit.
Unbelievable they were. Very good. We'll talk about that later. We might play a bit of Bee Gees as we go through the morning. Thank you. Natasha back with a news update, bottom of the hour. Those two young police officers who were murdered execution style, and that's the way you have to describe it, didn't stand a chance, according to Queensland Police Commissioner Katerina Carroll. She said she's paid tribute to Matthew Arnold, 26, Rachel McCrow, 29. What got me about this yesterday was that the four police walked down the driveway of this property, not knowing what they were going to encounter. They get fired upon, and then someone emerges and puts a gun to the two officers' heads and finishes them off and takes their Glock pistols. That sounds like, to me, something that would happen in the United States, perhaps, but not here. Not here, surely. Ian Leavers is the Queensland Police Union President. Ian, I'm so sorry for the loss of the police service in Queensland. It's just heartbreaking, mate.
Absolutely it is. And they were both two very young people who tragically their lives have been taken away. And I'll say this, they're both in their 20s. They haven't even lived life. And you're exactly right in what you said. They were executed by these ruthless, murderous, evil cowards who had no compassion for any person. And as well as the civilian who went to investigate, when they lit the grass fire with the policewoman Keeley, who retreated because they were trying to flush her out so they could shoot her and take her life as well. These are the sort of cowards that we were dealing with. And let's say this, that we tried to resolve the matter peacefully with our special operations group. They're unable to do that. But I'll say now that these three murderous, evil people will never go on to commit another crime again. It's just, as you said, this is what we hear in the United States. This is not Queensland. This is not Australia. And we are just lost for words at this point in time.
Yes, I don't think anyone would be crying any tears over the loss of those three. They are cowards, as you described them. They're murderous cowards. They're terrorists almost. And they were completely, it would seem, out of control. The point I want to make here, Ian, we're on air nationally. Every police officer in Australia today and yesterday and last night who put on the uniform, doesn't matter if they're in Victoria or New South Wales or Queensland, wherever they are, they would in their mind, and your experience would tell you this, they would think, am I going to be the next Matthew Arnold and Rachel McCrow to have someone kill me?
You're absolutely right. And whenever we go to calls for service, we know it could be us. It's just that is how it is in policing. And you're exactly right. Whether you're in Cairns or you're in Broome or down in Hobart, we all wear the blue shirt, and I'll even go as far to New Zealand. We're very close. That is the real risk we take, and it's very unpredictable. And you know that that very well could be me. And what I do know, that is in the thoughts of our loved ones, and they're the ones who really suffer in silence. And that's where we've got to get back to and try and, you know, realise the things that are really important in life. And I know as a result of what occurred earlier this week, for all those loved ones who've lost someone tragically across Australia and New Zealand, it brings back those memories. And I've had messages from widows who've lost partners 20 to 30 to 40 years ago and parents. It is as raw today as what it was 30 to 40 years ago. So the ripple effect right around the country is incredible. The only positive I've seen is the outpouring of emotion by the community. I've just been to Tara this morning. I'm back in Chinchilla, and a steady flow of members of the public from all walks of life are coming up, putting flowers at the police station, writing cards. And I read some of the cards at Tara this morning. It actually brings a tear to your eye when you see little kids writing cards, the school kids writing cards, and just people in the community showing their support for police. And I've mentioned, look, if you see a police officer anywhere in Australia, say good day and say thank you for your service, because that means a lot. And that's what keeps us going, and we'll continue to do our job, and we will do whatever we can to lock up these criminals and cowards to keep the community safe. And we're going to continue to do that with the community support. We'll rise above that, and that's what we're going to do.
Took me back. I must say I was on air in Victoria when the Wall Street murders happened. Two young police officers ambushed in a street in a ritzy suburb of South Yarra. and shot dead by criminals. And then I was also on air when the Silk Miller murders took place. Murdering police is just, it strikes at the core of our community, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And what resonated with me, and back to Tynan and Eyre in Melbourne, I started in the police in the late 80s. And whenever I went to a located stolen vehicle in an industrial area or a quiet area, that was in the back of my mind, and I was in Queensland. And that was always a fear, whether or not it was set up by these people who are nothing but cowards, terrorists, organised criminals. That was always a risk that you faced, and you just never, ever knew, and that is always in the back of your mind. And that's something you've just got to live with and you be aware of and do your risk assessments. But as we know, is what happened earlier this week, the risk assessments those young police did, I would have done exactly the same. They've got under 2 years service. I've got over 30 years service. They did all they possibly could and probably did more than what others would have. And there are some things you just cannot plan for, and that's the risk that we face in policing. And sometimes we know that when we put on that shirt and walk out the door, we know there's a very chance that one of us may never come home.
The young policewoman 8 weeks out of the academy who escapes one way, goes into the bush, the other officer goes the other way, and gets shot and has a gunshot wound. When she's in the bush there, she is so terrified. She's on her phone, obviously communicating with back to the station in Tara, but then texts her family, basically saying, Ian, I don't know that I'm ever going to see you again.
Absolutely. What she went through was absolutely horrifying. She was sending messages like, I love you. And I believe those close to her. So that's a bit out of character in some ways.
Well, this is Keely Brough we're talking about. She's 28 and Randall Kirk is 27. That's the two survivors.
That's it. Randall hopefully gets out of hospital today. We've spent time with him yesterday. But Keely, it was just courageous what she did, communicating with police to get extra support. But when they lit the fire to try and get her out, she knew if she stood up, she was going to be shot. And in that area, when you light the fire, she didn't know whether she was going to be burnt alive. But also, it is a snake-infested area. There were brown snakes out there. But the intel I've got back when the fire started to light, that the snakes become alive. And she was at risk of that. The meat ants, it was a terrifying situation for her. I can only imagine what was going through her mind. Because they really wanted to kill and murder her. It's just not the Australian way, and it's absolutely unacceptable. And what I've seen of late is the community come out, and it's not just in Chinchilla, Dalwi and Tara. It's across the country. People are appalled at this behaviour, and this is not the Australian way.
The police union just finally will now need to keep an eye clearly on Keely and Randall and the PTSD that they may suffer. Do you have the right things in place to help with that area?
Yes, we do. And that is something we advocate for now. And last year, I had some legislation put through where presumptive legislation for police who suffer PTSD. But what we'll do is get on the front foot. We don't want it to get to that point. And we will encourage and support counselling. And we're in an era now where thankfully, like when I joined the police, I'll be honest, mate, it's having a beer and doing a few other things was how you de-stress. But now we talk about living a healthy lifestyle and treating your mind. Your psychological fitness and well-being is just as important as if you pull a hamstring and you get treatment. And we're normalising that now, and we encourage that, and we're going to continue to drive that message. And I actually say it's the strong thing to do is to go and seek support for your psychological well-being. And so that's exactly what we'll be doing. But also with all the other colleagues as well, they are really hurting. They are very emotional at this point in time. They are very fragile, and they are coming to terms. And they actually just sort of, like today, the realisation is coming through. It was like they were hoping it was a bad dream, but it is reality. It has happened. It's set in. So there's going to be a lot of people requiring support, and we're going to drive that and make sure it happens.
And ultimately, it's too early now, but ultimately we need to come up with some way to remember Matthew Arnold and Rachel McCrow, and I'm sure you'll be at the forefront of that, Ian. Thanks for your time today. Appreciate it, mate.
Thank you very much.
Good on you. Ian Leavers there, Queensland Police Union President. The number of stabbing victims turning up at Victoria's emergency departments has soared over the last 12 months. These are new figures that have been put together by Monash University. Last financial year, 820 people presented to emergency departments after being stabbed. That's an increase of 48%. But that's not the number that stands out to me. What stands out to me is Typically, the victims were aged between 15 and 49, making up 87% of the cases. The age group that saw the largest number of victims was aged between 20 and 24. Teenage victims not far behind, 15 to 19-year-olds, a 12% increase. How is it that kids at the age of 15, 16, 17 are carrying knives, and why are they? And that crime's increasingly happening around train stations and at places of public transport. So if you've got a teenager, you just have to think to yourself, well, hell, hang on. Is it safe for them to go out on public transport if they're 17, 18, 19, when they need to be able to go out, and yet they could become a victim of a stabbing? Now, of course, 18-year-old Hashim Mohammed, he was killed with a knife. He was left to die, knife still in his back. Think about that. This is 2022 in the state of Victoria in the capital city, Melbourne. Let's go to Victoria. Annika Smethurst is the state political editor of The Age. Great to catch up again.
Great to catch up. You did scare me with that knife crime thing, though. I'm just coming out of a train now. Oh. You might hear a bit of background noise, so high alert.
Look, I must say I don't ever feel unsafe, but I do feel when I, you know, friends of mine who've got teenagers and, you know, you've got a newborn, so you've got this to look forward to down the track. Sending a 17-year-old out and saying, yeah, go on, go out with your mates, go to the city, that's fine. Yes. You think to yourself, oh, hang on, is it? And should I put him in an Uber? And, I mean, it is pretty scary.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I'm the same. I, at a very young age, was happy jumping on trains and thought I was invincible. And you like to think other people look out for kids out there. But as you say, that there's been some alarming stories recently, and it's the age of these kids, as you say, that are going out with knives and just, you know, not something that should be happening in our city, I would have thought.
3 weeks since the election almost. I'm guessing that's the number. I can't quite remember. It seems like such a long time ago. The Andrews government, new ministry sworn in. Obviously, everyone's going to head off into, you know, summer holidays. The agenda for the Andrews government, he spelled it out during the election campaign. What can we expect, do you think, going into next year out of this government? What's left to do?
Can we expect the Premier to stay around for the full term?
No way.
I guess what insiders are sort of dwelling on. Look, I think in terms of what has defined this government, and people will say different things, you know, I think it's hard to separate COVID, but in terms of policy, it really has been a big build government. It's something that there's been massive cost blowouts. Yes, that's true. But in terms of what they've achieved, you know, a lot of the talk about when the Premier will depart is perhaps after the Metro project's done, which is due sort of end of 2023, start of 2024. Rail hadn't really been built in this city for many years. They hadn't built any additional train tracks. So I think that's sort of a huge achievement. That's the sort of stuff when we get asked out with the Premier. They're the only sort of events he does these days. He doesn't fill that media cycle like the Prime Ministers do and do an event every day. He selects when he comes out, and they're a couple of times a week. And when he does, it is more often than not talking about infrastructure projects, particularly that rail project, less so Steve, the Westgate Tunnel, which of course has been sort of had a lot of problems attached to it. But I think if you're talking about legacy, and I think that's where we are with the Andrews government, very few people, even though they've got a huge buffer, would expect them to get a fourth term. I think it'll be harder, especially without Daniel Andrews if he does go. So when we talk about legacy, I think there's two things he wants to be remembered for: as a socially progressive premier, and as well as an infrastructure building premier. So they're the sort of themes we're going to see out of his government in the next 4 years.
You wrote a couple of days back about the social media campaign in the election battle. As a senior journalist at the Age, traditional media, big-selling daily newspaper, and obviously, clearly, I've worked on, you know, commercial radio in Melbourne, talkback radio. How are we ever going to get back to getting the Premier to pay attention to traditional media? He seems to have worked out, I don't need the Virginia Triolis of this world. I don't need Neil Mitchell. I don't need Steve Price. I don't need The Age. I don't need the Herald Sun. He's worked his way around it.
Yeah, look, I do think there is some risk of that for traditional people in the media like us. I always do try and remind people, listeners, readers, that we don't, the reason we have journalists is so we don't, you know, read directly press releases, so that we do get it through a different lens, not just straight from the government. I think social media has been an amazing addition in terms of being able to, for people to speak directly to voters or to their audience, whatever it is. But, you know, we should all be a little bit sceptical of directly reading messages from the government. It's like when a press release lands in my inbox or your inbox, Steve. We usually try and read between the lines to see what they're really saying. They don't often admit their mistakes. They don't often admit when costs blow out. And they try and, of course, spin it. That's why they pay a lot of people to work for them and spin. So, look, they do think they've got away with it. I do think in many ways, you know, that has made our job different. I do think that, though, it's very easy to feel that way when you've got a big buffer. But come election time, we even found it during the last few weeks, they still do need traditional media. And what you hear from the parties is that traditional media might not necessarily change a vote, but it does set the tone, the conversation for the day, for themes that people are getting throughout the election. So ignore it at your peril is, I think, is the message I would take.
Yeah, they try and pretend they don't read it, by the way, and you know they do.
Oh, we do.
We had Adam Bandt, the Greens leader, on the desk on the project on Monday night, and it was a live interview, and then we went to an ad break, and he turned to me and said, "You haven't written a column about me for a while. I need you to give me some more publicity." So I thought that was hilarious.
Yes, we know they all do it. They actually pay people to go and sift through everything that's published and to present it to people when it's about them. So, of course, they do read it. I do think, you know, it is something that media have to take on too. We're not as, you know, I've been doing this for 15 years and a front page story used to have a very different impact to what it does now. And I think that's something we have to consider as an industry as well.
We'll keep doing what we do. And thank you very much for your help during the year. It's been invaluable, Annika, and your reporting in The Age has been invaluable as well. Thanks a lot.
I've loved being part of the show. Congratulations.
Good on you. Annika Smithhurst there, State Political Editor from The Age. The pregnant wife of one of those police officers who escaped with his life from the shooting on the Darling Downs has revealed her husband's first thoughts were for his fallen colleagues. News.com.au is reporting that Chinchilla-based Constable Randall Kirk, he was the one who attended that property, he himself survived. Now, he was wounded and was taken to the local Chinchilla hospital. He's told the Warwick Stanthorpe Today on Tuesday that, "I'm feeling fine, just a little sore." He said, quote, and this is how the police react in these things, "My main thoughts are with the other police families at this awful time." And Constable Keely Brough, who'd only been in the force for 9 weeks, we know that she was forced to flee into the bush and they then set fire to it. One of the things that we'd never thought of is that bush is also full of snakes, which is incredible. So speaking to the Stanthorpe newspaper, Constable Kirk's wife, Brianna, said he'd had minor surgery in Toowoomba on Tuesday morning. He was doing well. She said, "When I first spoke to Randall at the Chinchilla Hospital, his first thoughts were for his colleagues. We extend our deepest condolences to the family and friends of Randall's deceased colleagues." Put that through your filter. This young police officer, he survived. Just how, no one knows. He escaped with a bullet wound. If he'd been killed also, he's got a pregnant wife. It's just extraordinary what unfolded out there. Just horrible, horrible, horrible story.
Overseas now, and Bali bomb maker Umar Patek has apologised to Australians for his role in the 2002 terror attacks. Patek was last week granted parole after serving just half of his original 20-year jail sentence. He's told reporters he's sincerely sorry for his involvement when he arrived at a de-radicalisation centre in East Java.
I also apologise to the Australians who also experienced a very great impact from the Bali bombing crime that occurred.
That translation, thanks to Channel 9, the Bali bombings killed more than 200 people, including 88 Australians. Steve, that's the latest from the newsroom.
Yes, we should never forget that anniversary.
Absolutely. And the lives that are still affected, not just physical scars for all the families and survivors, they still have great emotional scars. We spoke to my great friend, Ali Donaldson, who did a podcast and a special
she did
on Channel 10. And she went back and spoke to the survivors. She heard stories that she's never heard before. She was one of the first journalists on the ground in 2002. And that's very, very hard to hear, that That bomber served just, what, half of his 20-year sentence?
Yeah, we interviewed Peter Hughes on the project on Monday night. It might have been on last Thursday. And he said not a day doesn't go past when he doesn't think about it.
All those people had life sentences, Steve, if they were lucky enough to survive.
Yeah, incredible. And you remember the pictures of Peter Hughes with his awful, swollen, burned face. Mm. Just awful stuff. Thank you, Natasha. Natasha Belling back. News update, top of the hour. It was back on Thursday, November the 17th, when I spoke to the Federal MP Andrew Gee about what was unfolding in the town of Eugowra. Now, Cabon Mayor Kevin Beattie will join me in a moment, but here's what Andrew Gee told us about some of the incredible rescue stories in Eugowra.
It's just heartbreaking for Eugowra. That's all you can really say. Words can't really describe the hurt and the pain that's going on in Eugowra at the moment, and it's going to be a long, hard road to recovery. There are stories of great heroism here, I have to say. Community members, young blokes on trucks who are just going around pulling people out of homes with rising flood waters and getting the RFS ladder off the truck and putting them onto the roof and the veranda of the pub. There was one guy who was telling me that he was in his ute. The water, it was a tsunami coming at him, picked up the ute and smashed it into the side of a house. So he was trapped in there, couldn't open the doors. Luckily, he was able to wind down the window of the ute, which was lined up with the window of the house. That's the only way he could get out. So he gets into the house, and in the house are three kids and a mum. So he helps the mum and three kids get into and then onto the roof. And he said just as he hoisted the last child up, the floodwaters were around his neck. Other families just had miraculous escapes.
Just extraordinary what happened there. That was Andrew Gee describing it to us. And just think about this. This is not a month ago. That's November 17. We're at December 14 today. Kevin Beattie, Cabon Mayor, joins us. How'd you feel listening to that, back to that?
Yeah, good morning, Steve. Yeah, it takes me back to those days. Yeah, look, many, many stories very similar to that. Just incredible and well summed up by Andrew, really. Words cannot describe what took place over there.
That was a tsunami that went through there, wasn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, look, just two walls of water. Incredible. Some of the stories that we've heard, just amazing. And look, unfortunately, we lost two lives, but we could have lost a lot more.
I think it's important for us to come back and talk to the communities again and again, because too easily the rest of the capital city media forget about what went on. I spoke to Steve Craig from Lismore earlier this week, and they're still struggling 9.5 months on. How are you coping 3.5 weeks later or 4 weeks later?
Yeah, look, it's been a big 3 weeks to 4 weeks, as you said. Some of our other communities that weren't as devastated have started to get up back on track, but there's still work to be done there, Steve. So like for example, in Molong, some of the businesses have opened up and been able to operate, not at full capacity, but leading into Christmas, they're trying their best, and which is fantastic. But some of them haven't been able to open because of the devastation that happened in Molong also. But look. And definitely the same situation in Eugowra because the amount of damage that was done over there. So a few businesses have opened up over in Eugowra, but the majority haven't because of that devastation.
What about the wider Shire and the impact on agriculture? We know that it was almost impossible to get heavy machinery onto paddocks. Have they dried out and are they facing devastation with their crops, or are some savable? What's the wider story? And I know it varies greatly, suburb to community to community, because it's so different places.
Look, absolutely. And I'm glad you raised that, because the farming communities are a little bit forgotten in these floods, and they've suffered some devastation themselves. As you mentioned, crops have been destroyed. A visual example of that would be the crop that actually, there was a canola crop that went through the town of Eugowra. It had just been harvested, ready to strip, and that crop was $200,000, went straight through Eugowra in that flood. There's many, many other crops that have been destroyed. We've had stock numbers. People are still looking for missing stock, presumed that those animals are dead. And the fencing, like the infrastructure, kilometres and kilometres, hundreds and thousands of kilometres of fencing along the waterways from the top of the Shire here in Molong right through to Eugowra, along those waterways, just
incredible amount of infrastructure damage to those farms.
You and I have spoken before about the roads. They're so important, particularly if there needs to be heavy vehicle movement through the Shire. How are you coping with road repairs? Have you got the finance and the funds you need to do it?
Yeah, look, the state government's been pretty good with coming forward with finance for pothole fixing and some of our road repairs. We've also had an extra 200 Traffic for New South Wales crews in the central west doing some of our road work. So that has been a really, really relief to our road crews. It's allowed them to get onto the smaller roadways, which are also as devastated as the main arterial routes. So that's been quite good. So we're starting to get a little bit on top of them, but there's a lot of work to be done.
So you do have the government support that you need. What about the people of Yugara who are now homeless? Where do they go?
Yeah, look, the caravan rollout by Resilience has started and that's begun. And, look, unfortunately, some people are going to be in caravans for a little while until they can restore their homes or rebuild their homes. But, look, I've spoken to both the state and federal government. We need to have what's called the Back Home Grant initiated by both the state and federal governments. And that's a $20,000 grant from to homeowners to get them started. You know, they come in with some initial funding, but we do need more. As you've seen with the devastation to Yugara, there's some people not insured and the insurance is not paying out because of the flood damage. So we need more financial support from the government to get these people started.
And who are you putting pressure on to get that to happen?
Well, both state and federal. I've been to the Premier's office and I've also spoken to the Prime Minister's office about this. I'm hopeful that will come about very shortly because we really need that financial support.
I know it's early, but, I mean, how do you then broach the very tricky subject of rebuilding in an area that might eventually again flood?
Yeah, look, that is a very difficult situation. I guess the town of Yugara is keen to rebuild. They want to stay in Yugara, but there's obviously some areas there that are too low level, and we'll have to look seriously about rebuilding in those sorts of areas.
Insurance is impossible to get. You know, I saw a figure today, the Insurance Council of Australia, saying that since January 2020, the insurance bill for floods has topped $12.3 billion, with $477 million in insured losses for the floods in New South Wales, Victoria and Tassie, the recent ones. Insurance can only go so far. They're not going to reissue insurance. No one will be able to afford it. That's one of the problems, isn't it?
That's exactly it. And that was the problem even before this incident, Steve, that there were some of those houses the business premises weren't able to obtain insurance because it was just unaffordable. You know, a modest three-bedroom home has been quoted $40,000 for an insurance premium for a year. It's just not affordable.
Yeah, no one can afford to do that. Good to catch up with you. A pleasure to talk to you again, Kevin. Look after yourself and give our best wishes to everyone out there.
Thanks, Steve.
Good on you, Kevin Beattie there, Cabon Mayor. To our listeners in South Australia, you might have heard in the news update there that there's searches underway off Cape Jaffa now. That's on the southeast coast. Apparently, a woman has fallen overboard from a Carnival Australia cruise ship. She's a young woman travelling with a family member, fell overboard at 11:30 at night. Now, good luck. I mean, who would have even known that that had happened? The cruise ship's known as the Pacific Explorer. It stayed on site to try and find her, presumably. The cruise ship left Melbourne on Tuesday, so yesterday. They were off to Kangaroo Island, so knowing South Australia as I do, they would have come out of Port Adelaide or Outer Harbour and headed southeast toward Kangaroo Island. Cape Jaffa, they're 70K off the coast from Cape Jaffa. SA police said there's an air search underway. Assistance from Polair and a Challenger aircraft from Essendon Airport. The cruise ship also trying to help. A Carnival Australia spokesperson said the woman's family member was being cared for by an onboard team while every effort is being made to find the guest. This is an incredibly distressing situation for everyone involved and all our remaining guests. You would think that ship would now head back to its home port, you would reckon. And a report today in the Herald Sun saying that in Victoria, road and rail projects, and this is not just Victoria but around the country, are facing budget blowouts and delays due to an overflowing construction pipeline and critical skills and material shortages. Now, we've heard about this all year. Infrastructure Australia's annual market capacity report shows the price of core materials has gone up by, listen to this, 24% a year. Labour costs have risen 14%, and they are putting huge pressure on big infrastructure projects. There's a whopping $237 billion pipeline of projects over the next 5 years. And all of that is taxpayers' money. They're government projects. Victoria's the biggest, $60 billion. Love to know where all the money's coming from. Speaking about money, Scott Phillips from Motley Fool, their Chief Investment Officer, host of the Good Oil and Motley Fool podcast on the Listener app, joins us. We're not being shy on spending money on infrastructure, Scott.
Mate, there's plenty of money going out the door, isn't there? And look, this is always the challenge with... Look, governments have had a really tough job over the last 3 years. We know COVID was out of the blue. We've had to respond. I'm pretty dirty that there wasn't enough kind of, you know, plans in place. There should have been one of those in case of emergency break glass type plans. Everything had to scramble. And I guess, you know, again, that's not the fault of the then government or the now government, you know, but governments plural up to that point. But when you try and say, okay, now what do we do? Quick, let's go and do some things. That's what they did. And look, it's not a bad response, but as you've already said, the challenge now is we have an absolutely full infrastructure pipeline, not enough people to do the work, and inflation is through the roof. I'm kind of, you know, keen enough for them to do infrastructure projects, these things, as long as they're clever and not just, you know, political boondoggles, can be really, really effective ways of improving the economy. So conceptually, I think we all love the idea of making the country better, more efficient, easier, just whatever that is, whether that's, you know, road, transport, rail, buildings, bridges, whatever else we're doing. But as you say, at some point, you've got to kind of use these things countercyclically. When unemployment is 3.4%, it's not the time to be adding to that capacity constraint, given the private sector is absolutely desperate for workers. Now, a lot of these companies, of course, are private-public partnerships. They're individual contractors, so it's not just government workers. But it is a time when you've got to say, yep, we pushed the pedal down hard. Let's pull up just a little bit, try and relieve some of this pressure, because this is part of what's causing the problems. And frankly, if you're paying, you know, top dollar, 25% more odd for some of those raw materials, you'd almost be saying, you know what, we don't need this just now. Let's put the pause on this. When prices come back down, let's go and do it then. If that was your eye, that's what we'd be doing. Hopefully governments are listening as well.
Yeah, if you're going to renovate a house and you know that the materials will be cheaper in 6 months and you can afford to wait, why wouldn't you wait? Exactly. What do you take out of these US inflation figures released for November?
Really good numbers, mate, in a relative sense. Obviously, horrible numbers in general. 12 months ago, if you told me those numbers were going to be the case, as I've said before, you know, falling off my chair. But really, really good results. So down from 7.7 to 7.1%, the lowest inflation number in the US in 12 months. And on the back of our inflation falling only a couple of weeks ago, I'm not going to call it a trend yet. I'm not that courageous. But they're going in the right direction. That's pretty positive. Core inflation is still up a little bit, but again, you want a bit of inflation anyway. So the challenge is those annual numbers. Can they keep coming down? It seems like energy prices are stabilizing around the world, despite what's happening here at home. It seems like the impact of those central banks around the world, the US Federal Reserve, the RBA here, the Bank of England, European Central Bank, these guys are seemingly having an impact. Now, maybe it's just correlation. Maybe it would have happened anyway, but in either case, if we're going to go into next year in potentially tougher economic times, at least with slightly less inflation, full employment, gives us a fighting chance to avoid a recession. I don't know if we can, but it's about the best place you can ask to start for, given where we were only 3 short months ago.
But if you layer those numbers over the Australian scene, we talk about in the US cheaper or lower energy prices offsetting rising food costs. That's not us. Our energy costs are going up.
So I think that's there's lots of moving parts here. The household energy prices will continue to increase, and that's the big challenge. We talked about that a few times already in the last couple of weeks. That is going to continue to be an issue. The wholesale price of petrol, price of diesel is coming down or has been coming down. So that's a positive. I am looking for the positives, mate, but you're right. There are definitely reasons to be mindful, if not concerned, at least mindful that maybe we won't have the same success here. Our inflation has started to come down, of course, a little bit. That happened because it had a couple of weeks ago. So if that can continue, if we can get lucky enough, and frankly, at this point, it's kind of half, you know, skill, half luck. If we can be lucky enough, if those prices, particularly for fossil fuels. We're talking about oil here in particular, but also gas, not at a household level, but at a transport level, that's going to be a positive. It turns out, you know, yes, the energy prices are a massive issue for households. People listening, can I pay the bill? Small businesses, can I pay those bills? At a total market level, a total inflation level, energy is still, it's not small, but it's not the overwhelming part of the inflation number. And so what's most important inflation-wise, systemically, again, different if you've got to pay the bills, but systemically, is if that transport cost broadly can come down, the cost of getting food to the supermarkets, of getting trucks out in the mines, those kind of things, if that can continue to come down, that's the stuff that feeds into long-term inflation. So I'm cautiously optimistic there. The price could go up tomorrow for all we know, but if that can stay low, that and wages are probably the two biggest kind of feedback loops in the inflation story. And if they can stay low, we're in a good place.
I'm going to talk to Kira Ruddick from Ukraine after the news at the top of the hour. The war over there doesn't seem like it's going to stop anytime soon. So those energy pressures are going to continue. I tell you what, you know, plenty of people think being a director on a board is a doddle and you just turn up and you go to four meetings a year and shuffle papers. Those board members from Star Entertainment Group would be feeling a little queasy today.
Yeah, and they should be. ASIC has got them clearly in its sights. Look, most of the time, it probably is. You know, if you're in a reasonably ordinary normal business doing your thing, you're probably not worried too much. But it is a really good reminder that if directors and executives, by the way, 11 Star directors and executives are being sued by ASIC, the maximum fine $1.05 million if they're found guilty. And it comes down to whether or not they put enough time and attention to making sure the company was following the law. And it is a reminder for those directors and execs, you know, fine to say, yep, get me some more money or you know, turn up your four board meetings a year, probably a few more than that, but you know what I mean. The key thing here is that they simply didn't, or at least ASIC is alleging they didn't discharge their duties appropriately. They knew or could have known that there was some stuff going on that deserved greater scrutiny. That scrutiny wasn't forthcoming in ASIC's view in its allegation. And if that's the case, they have potentially failed to discharge their duties as directors and can be on the hook. And these guys too, a lot of these directors are, you know, career directors now. They're either late career or doing as well as other executive jobs. These are really significant charges. And I hope it does remind all directors across the economy, because you know, we want companies doing the right thing. Had these directors, assuming that they're found to be responsible, had they actually been a little more diligent in making sure these things didn't happen, had they asked the right questions, maybe some of these things might have been avoided. And that's for shareholders, for the economy. I don't know any of the casino inquiries that have come up with the casino saying, yep, you're doing the right thing. Don't worry, guys. It's all been, I think without exception, you've done the wrong thing. You've got to smarten up your act.
Habs, 100%. Talk to you tomorrow, mate. Thanks a lot. Scott Phillips there from Motley Fool.
Steve, Twitter owner and Telstra boss Elon Musk is no longer the world's richest man. He's been knocked off the Forbes list as number one by the CEO of luxury brand Louis Vuitton's parent company, LVMH, Bernard Arnault. His family is now the world's richest with a personal worth of around $188 US billion.
Elon, two?
Yes.
And Bill Gates, I think, four?
Yeah, I lose track when you talk. It's just a couple of billion.
And Sanjeev Gupta, who's got very strong Australian connections, fourth richest person in the world, owns the Adani Coal Mine in Queensland, the Whyalla Steelworks in South Australia, major sponsor of the Port Adelaide AFL Club, got huge assets in India. Just shows the shifting wealth of the world, that it's, you know, going away from China, away from Russia, and into places like India and the US.
Media bosses used to be the some of the richest.
I wonder if
men
Elon
in the world.
Musk would ever consider running for president.
Please don't.
That'd be a good idea.
Steve, I'm just struggling to get
Donald
through.
He could be Donald Trump's deputy.
I'm just struggling to get through this year, okay? Don't trigger me with even suggesting that.
What about if Donald Trump announced a joint ticket with Elon?
Okay, that's enough.
Don now. And Elon.
I'm done. I can't. And Bernard Arnault, so it's his
Hennessy
family's,
Moet, yeah. Cognac. Champagne.
So he gets free champagne as well.
And what's the clothing company?
Louis Vuitton.
Yeah, you'd like that. Handbags.
Struggling cost of living, wouldn't he?
Tough.
Would he be based in Paris?
Let's check if he's single. Gosh. Back after this.
Are you kidding?
Well, the war in Ukraine continues. We've been very lucky all year to be able to speak with Ukrainian MP Kira Ruddick. Now, as Australia gets ready for its summer holidays and Christmas period, the people of Ukraine got to keep fighting the Russian invasion. It gets colder and colder and colder by the week, and they are continuing to hit power plants, the Russians. It's a brutal assault, but the Ukrainian people have been absolutely magnificent. The Prime Minister of Ukraine has been speaking to the Parliament today, Vladimir Zelensky, and he has asked for more weaponry from the West, and let's hope that that is forthcoming. Kira Ruddock's been good enough to join us again. Thanks for your time. How are you coping?
Hello, Steve. Thank you so much for having me. Well, the winter is very tough here in Ukraine, and the attacks from Russia continues. So, like today, during the parliament sitting that we had to spend half of it at the bomb shelters because there was an air raid siren on, and we had to just protect ourselves and protect people who are working in the parliament. It's also very cold here. There is snow on the ground. It's still not like minus 10, minus 20, but the winter is on, and we have to prepare to it, and we have to figure out a way to deal with it. It is indeed hard to fight all the battles in all the fronts. So we have to support our army that is making it possible for us, Steve, to talk after all those months. We have to take care of each other because there are so many people who are taking it very hard. Imagine having little kids or having elderly relatives at the situation where it is dark outside, when the elevators are not working, traffic lights are not working, and everything becomes a complication, like even the very basic things like getting hot tea or charging your phone, etc. We have to fight on the international front to continue getting the support that we desperately need, because we rely on our allies financially, militarily, and of course in terms of humanitarian support. We have to keep the morale up, and we have to prepare for Christmas, for winter holidays. And it is both a sweet and bitter time right now, because on one hand, we are so happy that we survived. Remember, we never knew that we will get to this point, being alive and well. But also right now, knowing how many kids will have to celebrate their holidays without their parents. So one of the projects and goals that we all have is to make it easier on them. And this is why on the humanitarian front, we are asking not only for general support to survive through the winter, but also to help Ukrainian children who will be celebrating it alone.
History tells us that wars are often won and lost in winter in that part of the world. You need to read history to understand what might happen. Can you survive the winter?
Yes, we will definitely survive the winter. We were preparing to it. And right now, our army is much better equipped than Russians. Well, at least we have done everything for it to happen. So our soldiers have warm clothes, and we have more and more weapons delivered from our Western allies. And we know that Russia cannot congratulate themselves on having the same. And this is why, though a couple of months ago, we thought that the winter will be a frozen time. Right now, we know that it's our chance, our opportunity to push forward, our opportunity to get more of our land back and liberate our people. We have talked with you, Steve, that it's not border moving here and there. It's basically a huge division between where the human rights are being acknowledged and the ones we're not. Right now, when we are talking with you, there are definitely people on the occupied territories who are being tortured. We know that because on every single liberated city and village, we have found the results of what they were doing to our people, of so unspeakable things that one cannot even process. And this is why we will be using this opportunity to fight back, to push, and hope this winter will not be a frozen time, but also be a time for us to get closer to the victory.
Odessa got hit by a particularly big lot of missiles where they knocked out a lot of the power. 1.5 million people without power for some time. What do you know of what's happening in Odessa at the moment?
it's hard everywhere in Ukraine right now. Odessa is not an exception. And we are really trying to fix the infrastructure as quickly as possible, but it's incredibly hard to do. So because of the massive destruction of the infrastructure everywhere, every additional hit here and there is really critical, because it can make like millions of people out of power for weeks. And this is a result of us not getting the air defense systems before the destruction happened, and just because we started getting it just right now. We are trying to make it easier on everyone. And from the places where there is electricity, we are in incredible savings mode to make sure that it is evenly distributed and people are being helped out. We know that it's our, you know, like, it's our national goal to survive it all together. So that amount of people who are getting into the winter will also be there in spring. And this is what we are fighting for, not only for ourselves, but for the communities around us.
We know there's brutality and torture, but there is also a question about the morale of the Russian soldiers. What are you hearing about the general Russian troops and what they would like to see happen here?
I think till right now, Putin is unable to clearly explain to his soldiers what are they doing and why. Why are they fighting somewhere in the foreign land where that they are saying it is ours, but it is not theirs, and people hate them and people protest against them, and the whole world is condemning them. This is why he's starting getting people from prison, basically prisoners, to fight, because it's very hard with the mobilization. People do not want to go and fight on their side. And we know that their morale is very low, because first of all, because they are not very well equipped. They are basically being thrown as a battle meat. And it's still unclear. And every time our soldiers are asking them, why are you here? Their best answer is, well, because we were told so. We are here protecting our land, our like ability to have future. And you know that this morale will always fight any other one, especially when their motivation is, oh, we were just told to be here.
What do you think the rest of the world now needs to do? We know that there has been a lot of support, but not enough, not as much as you need. As we go into Christmas and the rest of the Western world sort of half forgets about Ukraine, which should not happen, but they do. What does the rest of the world need to step up and do right now?
Send us more air defense that will allow us to survive, that will allow us to protect nuclear stations, that will allow us maybe to have Christmas where we will not spend it in bomb shelters. And this is the key thing that we need. With the rest, I know that when the whole world is off the holidays, we will continue pushing in political, humanitarian, military fronts. And we are very sure that we are going to win this war. And as of right now, the immediate and critical thing is protecting ourselves from the rockets that are going from the sky. This is simple as that.
Kira Ruddick, it's always a pleasure to catch up with you. We'll talk again. You keep yourself safe over the next few weeks. And God bless Ukraine.
Glory to Ukraine and happy holidays. Thank you, Steve.
The Australian Parliament will be recalled tomorrow, so all the MPs will be gathering around Australia as we speak, headed back toward Canberra. You know what? That's going to cost you and me, the taxpayer, all those Commonwealth cars, the white limos, the airfares, people flying in from WA, the Territory, South Australia, $1 million. It's going to cost the Australian taxpayers $1 million to recall Parliament for one day, and the bill might not even get up. It'll get through the reps because they've got the numbers, but it's still likely to be held up in the Senate. The Prime Minister was on ABC Radio yesterday and saying the government actually may consider adopting a national gas reservation policy. Now, he was asked on ABC Radio if we, as in the government, needed to look at a national gas reservation policy. The Prime Minister said we do need to look at that. And the opposition energy spokesman, Ted O'Brien, dismissed Mr. Albanese's comments as, quote, shallow thought bubble. but the oil and gas industries actually lashed the idea. Samantha McCulloch, she's from the Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association. She said, she told the Australian newspaper, the nation already has an Australian domestic gas security mechanism and a heads of agreement in place as mechanisms to ensure supply. Adding additional layers of regulation will only impact investment and our global reputation among trading partners. Now, New South Wales and Victoria have been pushing for a national gas reservation scheme. Interestingly, one government, a coalition of Liberal Nationals, and the other a Labor government. Queensland said on Tuesday it continues to do the heavy lifting on domestic gas. WA, of course, has a gas supply legislation in place, reserving gas for people in WA. One of the most remarkable backflips that I've seen in recent times came from Health Minister Mark Butler this week. Now, he has revealed that if you want a PCR test now, you're going to have to go to a GP and get a GP to suggest that you need it, to diagnose you as needing a PCR test. That kicks in from January 1, which means you're going to have to pay for it. But the most remarkable thing that's had no publicity almost is this idea that patients from now on will only be able to claim Medicare rebates for 10 visits to a psychologist or allied mental health service next year, down from 20 visits. Now, the 20 went in through the Better Access program that happened during COVID. And the Health Minister Butler said, while Better Access had offered benefits for people using it, not everyone had been able to access it equally. That seems like very bizarre logic to me. Melissa McIntosh is the Shadow Assistant Minister for Mental Health and Suicide Prevention. Melissa, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me on, Steve.
I would have thought we'd be increasing people's access to mental health help, not decreasing it.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. I heard Minister Butler being asked today if he thought that there was a mental health crisis in this country, and he wouldn't answer that. There surely is one, absolutely. And we are actually facing a tsunami of mental health issues over the next 2 to 3 years because of the pandemic, because of natural disasters. And I've had floods in my community. I know the impact on people's mental health. It's right. We should not be cutting it. Now is not the time. People going through a lot, our young people who've been, you know, doing their HSC during lockdowns, being isolated. We need to be giving all the support to Australians who are in need right now.
And you can throw in there Australian veterans who come back from serving overseas. We've had that awful Melissa police shooting in Queensland. You've got first responders who need mental health care. What's Butler's excuse for wanting to do this? Is it purely financial?
I actually don't really understand it at all. When I'm speaking to psychologists, and I've received emails over the last 24 hours from psychologists in my local area, they don't understand it either. They don't understand the rationale of cutting 20 in half to 10 means that more people will get access. How does that make sense? And Minister Butler couldn't answer today whether there was a budgetary benefit to the cut. So I think there's some more questioning that needs to be done. And as you said, there hasn't been an abundance of publicity on this significant issue. Mental health, I think every person knows somebody who is struggling with their mental health. And very sadly, many of us know people who have attempted to take their own lives because of their struggles. So now is not the time. As we said, we are coming through a pandemic, but it's definitely not over. A woman emailed me just last night telling me about how these sessions have helped her daughter and other family members, these additional 10 sessions, and they're really concerned what this means now for their ability to access mental health services. And as I said, psychologists are asking those same questions too. So I think the minister still has a lot of questions to answer, why he has done that now, and also approaching Christmas. We know that people do suffer mental health problems more over Christmas and experience things like loneliness. So just the thought of having those 20 sessions cut down to 10 over this time of year, pandemic, disasters, is quite extraordinary.
What would be, I mean, you're not a medical professional, neither am I, but I mean, if you're midway through the 20 and you're suddenly told, okay, you've only got 3 appointments left now, That in itself would have a mental impact on you, wouldn't it?
I think the uncertainty that this provides or the impact of the uncertainty on people now who have been relying on having those 20 sessions, I think that would cause a bit of anxiety. I think we need to know from the Minister for Health, if he's cutting these sessions, well, what's he doing to provide additional mental health support for Australians who need it most? We know there's workforce shortages. We need more psychologists in the system. So rather than cutting now and not having an answer, how about you continue those sessions and let Australians know what you're going to be doing, what's your plan to provide better mental health access for Australians who need it right now more than ever?
I have done story after story this year on this program about the impact of COVID in 2020, 2021 on young people. Those that were in, you know, years 9, 10, 11 and 12, particularly that cohort that spent 2020 and 2021 in years 11 and 12 and had to try and, you know, complete their higher studies while doing it from home on Zoom without face-to-face teaching. Many of those youngsters have struggled mentally, not able to see their friends, not able to play competitive sport, not able to socialise in a way that all young people need to be able to socialise. Why would we be ripping out mental support when you know that you've got that problem? And much of the COVID problem probably hasn't even surfaced yet. It's still to come.
Yeah, exactly right. The experts say it's going to be 2 to 3 years, possibly more, before we see the full extent of the COVID pandemic on the mental health of Australians and in particular young people. And my son, I know personally, he was in year 12 in 2020, and I know how hard it was to be locked up in your room, not having access to your friends, really trying hard, and then going off first year of uni and then not having any sort of interaction with friends in first year of uni. And these are young people who've had multiple years of first but not being able to experience that. So now, again, is not the time. We should be investing in the mental health of our young people, all Australians, and also, as you said, our veterans. I want to see more investment in our veterans who, I've got a great veteran community out here in Western Sydney, and I know that a lot of them are needing a bit of extra support as well. And there were initially cuts to a very important veteran mental health service until we caused a bit of a fuss about it, and that was reinstated by the government. So I think, again, we need to cause a bit of fuss and get the right mental health services for the Australians who need it most.
How upset are you finally to having to go back to Canberra tomorrow and the government's not even going to allow question time?
It's quite extraordinary. You know what? I'm actually not going back. I'm doing something for my family. It's my little girl's 12th birthday and she's in year 6 this year. And because of the reasons of not having a great schooling over the last couple of years of COVID, I've decided I won't go because I actually disagree with us having to do that and the money that will be spent, but most importantly, to be here for my family at this time.
But,
absolutely. And to be with my community. My community has been through so much over the last couple of years, being hit by fires, floods and the pandemic. And I've got a number of schools that I want to get to today and tomorrow before they close. And I think that should be the priority of our parliament, is representing our community first.
I think you've got your priorities exactly right. Thanks, Melissa. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Melissa McIntosh there, Shadow Assistant Minister for Mental Health and Suicide Prevention. That's just crazy what the government's done there.
Let's check the weather details around the country for this Wednesday, the 14th of December. Orange, top of 14 today, partly cloudy. Partly cloudy also for Bathurst, top of 17 degrees. Mostly sunny, high of 20 degrees today for Mudgee. Mostly sunny also for Dubbo, 22. Possible shower or two for Canberra, 17 degrees. 19 and a possible shower developing for Wagga. Partly cloudy, 21 for Griffith. Mostly sunny for both Coffs Harbour and Port Macquarie today. Mount Gambier, low of 8 today, top of 16 and cloudy. And showers with a possible storm on the way for Hervey Bay, high of 29.
Extraordinary stuff right around the country. The weather is very variable at this time of year. Snow in the Alpines.
And then bushfires in WA. Can I just make a quick point, Steve? Great interview regarding the cutback to the mental health payments and Medicare subsidies for so many Australians right now. The other big issue, they come out and talk about PCRs, that announcement with the health minister. Then literally a couple of hours later, the health department had to clarify the points.
So what is the situation now if you need a PCR test?
Well, come January 1, I guarantee you the devil's in the detail. They've tried to bury the story because no one actually knows what will happen with PCRs. The issue is, as you know, with these new variants, I know a lot of people that have tested negative on a rat that we have to go and pay for.
Yes.
And then
it's
they've
not
gone
picking
to
them up. The rat tests now no longer picking this variant up.
Correct. Then they go and get a PCR and test positive. The other big issue in regional areas and for a lot of places that are seeing doctors' shortages, if I think I'm sick and I live in regional Australia, I have to wait 4 to 6 weeks to see a doctor. So if I'm an elderly person and need to get antivirals or immunocompromised, I need to take those.
How do we get to this mess?
Oh, don't start me, Steve, because they want everyone to get COVID and they've completely and absolutely botched the COVID strategy.
It doesn't seem to be working anywhere.
We spoke with an infectious diseases expert, Dr. Brendan Crabb from the Burnett Institute, and he said to us, and this is in a special episode for Morning Agenda, will air over Christmas. He said this is the worst public health disaster in Australia since World War II.
Wow. Okay. Well, there's a long way to go on the COVID story. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Thanks for your help today.
Excellent.
Natasha Belling back with us tomorrow morning. Let's go travelling now. Michelle Slack-Smith is with Adventum Travel, and we're going to talk about a white Christmas. Michelle, by the sound of Natasha's news update there, you can have a white Christmas at Mount Buller now if you want to.
Absolutely, or even in orange.
Yes.
It's pretty chilly here today. I've got a scarf on, so I feel like I'm having the white Christmas.
It's not quite what we had in mind, though, you and I, when we decided to talk about this. There is obviously some sensational places you can travel to, principally Europe, I suppose, but also the northern parts of the United States. And a white Christmas does really feel very much different to anywhere else. I mean, I've been in Germany, for example, over the December-January period, and those Christmas markets that the Europeans have are just sensational, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely next level. And I think, you know, even just snow, experiencing the snow fields in Australia, even in the middle of winter, as opposed to the snow in North America or Europe, is so different, you know. And the Europeans know how to do it really well, from the Christmas markets through to, you know, the snow fields over that Christmas period, you know, through to the windows in Harrods. I mean, David Jones do a great job in Sydney, but, you know, it's next level for, you know, department stores like Harrods and Harvey Nicks. It's really an incredible scene.
I can brag a little bit here. It's okay because we are talking travel. I do remember one Christmas morning taking my small children up to the Eiffel Tower in Paris on Christmas morning, just after they'd opened their Christmas presents. That was an incredible time to be in Paris for Christmas Day. And the other one I remember, and you know, I'll get in trouble for talking about this, but I was in Venice in Italy for Christmas, and my children demanded a Christmas tree, and we were staying in a hotel. And so I thought, well, where the hell am I going to need a Christmas tree? I found a nursery of all places in Venice, and then in broken Italian found out they had some trees out the back. And the bloke offered to transport the tree by boat to the hotel and set it up. I think it was the most expensive Christmas tree I've ever had in my life.
No, absolutely. Well, as we said, the Europeans really know how to do it well. And I guess that's one of the things is, you know, they'll go to any length to ensure the Christmas spirit. But I guess one of the really, you know, if you really want to experience the ultimate Christmas is Lapland. So there's lots of different tours that happen, you know, through that Christmas period. You know, flying into Helsinki, you get the Santa Express overnight, you know, and then you can stay at a reindeer farm, visit the Northern Lights. You know, it really is that incredible Christmas, ultimate Christmas experience.
Gee, I'm glad my children are too old now for me to have to put myself through that. It sounds for me like torture. What about New York? I mean, Macy's and Fifth Avenue, the decorations, incredible.
Absolutely. Well, I really think the big tick box for New York is the Rockefeller Center, ice skating there and ice skating in Central Park. You know, I mean, I was there not at Christmas, but the end of November. And, you know, that is amazing. All the Christmas decorations are out there. Christmas music is, you know, pumping, and ice skating around the Rockefeller Center is, again, one of those incredible experiences, you know. that you and I, as we have spoken over the last few weeks, are really fortunate enough to and privileged enough to have experienced many of these travel destinations.
Oh, I even managed to go to the Christmas Eve Rockettes show in New York, which was fantastic, fantastic.
But in saying that, we're talking about all these, you know, wonderful experiences overseas. Bondi Beach has made the top 10 destinations to spend Christmas for 2023. So that's interesting as well. So, again, it's the opposite. I guess we live, well, besides the last couple of weeks, in a relatively warm country. And for Europeans, I guess it's an adventure to come and experience, you know, swimming in the beach and having, you know, seafood platter for Christmas lunch as opposed to a hot lunch. So, I guess it's the two opposite experiences for Christmas.
If you're a European tourist, that's exactly where you'd want to be. My advice, if you're travelling, go and see a travel agent. Adventum Travel, Michelle Slack-Smith, is in Orange. Great to catch up again. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Steve. Have a fabulous Christmas.
You too. Just talking about COVID with Natasha Belling. Dr. Andrew Rochford from My Health Records joins us. There has been some changes on exactly what's happening with COVID now. Andrew, we like to pretend it's gone away. It hasn't, has it?
No, absolutely not, unfortunately. I think that, you know, for us, we're going to be seeing waves and these waves coming through probably for the next few years as it continues to, you know, change and become different types of strains and, you know, different types of immunity. And we start to develop the vaccinations that can give us that long-term protection in the same way that, you know, we have a seasonal influenza vaccine. Ultimately, we'll likely get to a point where we have an annual COVID vaccine along with that. But for now, you know, our immunity wanes over a period of time, which means that you're exposed, you can get sick again. And if you're getting sick again, that means people around you can get sick again. So definitely something that will be with us for probably a very long time, but with these waves over the next few years, definitely.
How do antivirals work?
So an antiviral, basically, it's taken within a certain period of time. And what it does is it helps protect you from the severity of the disease. So it doesn't stop you from getting the disease. It's taken once you test positive. And in Australia, you know, recently we tried to see whether, you know, what are those target groups that see the most value out of antivirals, and that's just likely been changed. But it is those vulnerable groups over the age of 70, over the age of 50, if you have one of the other medical conditions, and also for First Nations, we see that those are the ones that benefit most from having antivirals early in the disease to reduce that severity, reduce the risk of death and hospitalisation.
How important is it when someone like Chris Hemsworth owns up that he might have a medical problem and he's going to take some time off because he's discovered through digging around in the background of his family that there is a DNA possibility he might have Alzheimer's? I guess that gets a lot of people thinking.
Yeah, it does. I think, you know, obviously communication and the way that we all, you know, gather our communication and information has changed. You know, the concept of influencers and those that, you know, have a voice within the community has changed. And I think that when it comes to, you know, these types of moments and these types of messages from people with profile, like Chris Hemsworth, it does make people start to recognise that, you know, maybe they need to start focusing on their health, whether there's other options for them. And, you know, there is a huge, you know, conversation, an ethical conversation about genetic testing and, you know, forecasting your future and all of those things. You know, is it better not to know or is it better to know so that you can change your lifestyle to, you know, to best get that quality and quantity of life? But, you know, they are, to me, when they are of value to the public conversation about health and an individual's health, I think they're hugely valuable. But unfortunately, there's just as many people with influence and public profile that do the same thing that isn't as helpful. And so that is the ever, you know, ongoing struggle that we have within public health.
Gee, it's a dreadful affliction, isn't it? I mean, you can't do anything to prevent it. If it's going to get you, it's going to get you.
Yeah, and I think that that's the point, is that we are striving so hard now to live longer. And with that, it's not that you're necessarily going to, you know, have those other challenges, but that if you live long enough, you are going to get disease and conditions, and dementia and Alzheimer's is one of those conditions that with us all living longer and certain lifestyle behaviours, we're seeing more and more of it. The really exciting thing is, and I was part of a future horizon scanning forum to start looking at where are these new therapies that are coming. It was put on by Medicines Australia that are going to change the face of certain diseases in this country. And there's some really exciting work coming out of the Alzheimer's and dementia space, not necessarily curative, but delaying the plaques that build up in the brain, they're seeing a regression in those, they're seeing improvements in clinical status. So that the statement was, it's not that we won't have Alzheimer's, it just won't, it, you won't die from it, you'll die with it. And I think that, you know, as much as, you know, it is a fairly bleak outcome at the moment, sort of a view at the moment, it is changing, and there's some really exciting research in therapeutics that hopefully in our lifetime we'll start to see that change.
Roger, great to catch up, mate. Talk again soon. Thanks a lot.
Cheers, Pricey.
Dr. Take care. Andrew Rochford from My Health Records.
Thanks for listening to this Australia Today podcast. For more of the stories that matter, search Australia Today on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. Listener.